This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Charles Mann, has written a book about an environmental upheaval that you probably never realized existed, and it dates back to Christopher Columbus. We know his voyage was the start of an era that brought slavery, smallpox, and syphilis to the Americas, but the ships carrying European explorers, traders, and colonizers also brought to the Americas plants, animals, insects, and other infectious diseases that would permanently change the biosphere. And when those Europeans returned to their own countries with plants, birds, insects, and microorganisms from the new land, it altered the environmental makeup of Europe. Mann says this was all part of the Columbian Exchange, an ecological convulsion and the greatest environmental event since the death of the dinosaurs. Charles Mann is the author of the new book 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. It's a follow-up to his book 1491. Mann is a correspondent for The Atlantic and Wired and spoke with Terry last week.
Charles Mann, welcome to Fresh Air. So just list some of the things that Columbus brought to the Americas.
Well, Columbus started off, he brought wheat, he brought cattle, he brought horses, he brought all kinds of plants that are in our gardens today. But almost as important, or even, and in some cases more important, were the things that he brought over and didn't realize. He brought over a whole plethora of diseases. He and his followers, I shouldn't say Columbus, just, the Spaniards who came after him, brought all these diseases that didn't exist in the Americas, and they brought all kinds of insects. The list is just absolutely enormous. One of the things that they brought over were plantains, or bananas, which are basically the same species, and they planted them because the Spaniards liked them. And they didn't realize it, but as the entomologist Edward O. Wilson, this famous entomologist, as postulated, they brought over some of the plantains' pests, which are these tiny little insects called scale insects that live on the roots of the plantains. And when they planted these big banana plantations all over Hispaniola, which is what the Dominican Republic and Haiti, which was a Spanish colony, it was led to this huge boom in the population of these scale insects. Now, on this island already was an ant, a fire ant, Solanopsis geminata, and it turns out to really, really like scale insects, particularly the excrement of them, which is very sugary. And it led to this huge population boom of the fire ants, which in turn led to something out of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, where there's this ant plague that drives Spaniards effectively off the island, and the few remaining are praying to the various saints to drive them away, and they're living on top of the roofs of their houses because their places are swarming. And this is the kind of ecological convulsion that I'm talking about, magnified 100-fold and spread across the world, that's created and set off by Columbus.
So you mentioned that these ants were on Hispaniola, the island that has the Dominican Republic and Haiti. It was that island that Columbus first tried to colonize. He founded La Isabella, named after the queen,
right,
who was funding him, in January 2nd of 1494. This was supposed to be, a permanent bastion in the heart of Asia, a headquarters for exploration and trade for Spain. So describe what actually happened when Columbus got to La Isabella.
Well, it was kind of a catastrophe. I mean, it only lasted for a few years. He set up this whole town, and he forced everybody to build a big mansion for himself and plant it with all kinds of European crops. And then he sent everybody off to discover the gold that he was absolutely sure was in the hills. And meanwhile, he went off to find China. And they didn't find much gold, and he, of course, didn't find China. And the whole thing dissolved into squabbling and Indian wars. And it would have been pretty much a thorough failure, except that about that time, the Spaniards accidentally imported diseases, particularly smallpox. And these kind of didn't exist at all in the Americas. This whole range of what they call crowd diseases that can be spread from person to person, didn't exist in the Americas at all by a quirk of history. And the reason is that when the continents broke up, there was no domesticable animals in the Americas. There were no horses. There were no cows. There were no sheep, there were no goats, there were no ducks. And one of the things that happened in Europe and Asia was that people lived for thousands and thousands of years right next to these domesticated animals, the cows and the horses and so forth. And every now and then, an animal disease can do what scientists call jump the species barrier and become a human disease. And so the most recent example would be bird flu, which everybody knows is a disease that, you know, started in some kind of bird and has now become a human disease. Well, all the great diseases, you know, from smallpox to measles to influenza, are this kind of disease. And none of them exist in the Americas because they didn't have any domesticated animals. And so when the Europeans came over, when Columbus started by Columbus, it was as if all the deaths over the millennia that have been caused by these diseases were compressed into 150 years in the Americas. And the result was to wipe out, you know, somewhere between two-thirds and 90% of the people in the Americas. And this had just, in addition to enormous human effects, I mean, it was the worst demographic catastrophe in history, it had enormous ecological effects because these people had been tending the landscape, managing the landscape, and suddenly it reverted into wilderness. One of the ironies of this is that, you know, I think we learn in school that Europeans came over to the Americas and sort of wrecked the wilderness. And what they in fact did was, in the most awful way possible, they created it. And this is part of the ecological convulsion of the Columbian Exchange.
So let's talk a little bit more about insects. You mentioned earlier mm-hmm. how the explorers inadvertently created an ant epidemic in Hispaniola. Europeans brought with them honeybees because they wanted honey. They didn't yet understand what pollination was, but the bees pollinated anyways. So how did the honeybee change ecosystems in the Americas?
Well, it did so in two ways, one that we know a lot about and one that we don't know so much about. And the one we know a lot about is that European crops, you know, from peaches to apples to strawberries to walnut trees, all depend on pollination and wouldn't, so far as we know, have been pollinated by native bees. What's remarkable about the European honeybee is that it's a promiscuous little beast, as the entomologists say, and it will pollinate practically anything. And so it made it possible for all these European crops to spread into the Americas. The other thing they did, European bees spread out over the landscape, and historical entomologists believe that they drove a lot of native bees extinct simply by, you know, crowding them out. And those native bees typically pollinated certain species, and those species were dependent on them for the pollination. And so they would have had a much harder time with European bees if European bees didn't happen to have the taste for them. And so historical entomologists believe, although they don't really know, that there was a kind of rolling wave of extinctions that went on as the European bees spread out into the Americas. And among the people who noticed this were native people who would see the European bees coming in, you know, far ahead of the Europeans themselves. And they called them European flies, and they were pretty sad when they saw them because it meant that the Europeans would be following.
Let's talk about Jamestown because it has a really interesting ecosystem subplot. Now, the colonizers came to Jamestown looking for silver and gold and expecting to find it. They didn't, but they started growing tobacco, and tobacco became really big there. They brought it back to England by ship, and here we start getting some really interesting, surprising ecological consequences. What happened?
Well, as you say, tobacco was this craze. It was, in fact, the world's first global commodity craze. And obviously, Virginia, one of the main supply places, this is a great thing. They start sending over huge quantities of tobacco. And the way they do this is by leveling the forest all over Chesapeake Bay and planting tobacco. And this has a couple of effects. The first is that tobacco is absolutely notorious for exhausting the soil. Basically, when you harvest tobacco, you harvest the whole thing, and so you're just essentially taking all the nutrients in the soil, putting it to this big plant, and then putting it in barrels and sending it on ships. The other thing that happened was that European ships would come in, and they would have ballast that would be necessary to balance the ship. And when they took in all these heavy barrels that would weigh, you know, half a ton or so, they would throw out the ballast, and the ballast had lots of soil in it, and the soil almost certainly carried earthworms. And the interesting thing about that is that all over the northern part of North America, there were no earthworms. They were destroyed by the Ice Age, so far as we know. And so all the earthworms that are now in the gardens of, you know, my garden in Massachusetts are imported. They're exotic species. And in the thousands of years since the Ice Age, an ecosystem had evolved in which earthworms didn't play a part, and the leaf litter, which is what earthworms eat, sort of piled up on the soil, and plants and trees, saplings, sought their nourishment in that. The earthworms move in. They eat all the leaf litter, all those plants. They simply starve to death. And the forests in places like, way upstate New York or Minnesota are dominated by sugar maples and a whole range of species that depend on them. All of a sudden, they can't survive. The sugar maple sprouts can't survive. And you get this radical change in the forest where new plants move in, and you get the kind of pine-dominated forest that you now see in New England.
Now, is it Jamestown that also brings malaria into America?
Yeah. No, there is no malaria in the Americas. This is a tremendous thing for native people. Of course, they didn't know it, because malaria is this tremendously wily parasite. It's a single-celled creature that has proven just extraordinarily difficult to eradicate and has had huge impacts in places like Africa, where there's all kinds of calculations by economists that if malaria hadn't existed in Africa for the last 200 years, it would just be fantastically wealthier than it is now, because so much of the continent's human capital goes into being sick all the time. So what happens is that there are malaria is this parasite that needs these particular mosquitoes to survive. They exist in the Americas, different species, but they're compatible with malaria. And Europe has malaria at this time, particularly southeast England, and it comes over in the bodies of colonists, gets picked up by the mosquitoes, and makes this broad band of the coastal Americas from Chesapeake Bay down to the southern border of Brazil just full of malaria, and it becomes quite inhospitable for European colonists. In a place like Virginia, they have to go through this process. It's called seasoning, which is you bring over an indentured servant, and then you sit around and wait for a year to find out if he's going to survive or not. And death rates are up to 40%. So you bring over these servants, and 40% of them kick the bucket in the first year, and many of them are sick for long periods thereafter. It's hugely expensive. And at that point, people start looking around, and they start seeing Africans. Now, the interesting thing about Africans is that they're, in a sort of a strict Darwinian-type sense, they're genetically superior to Europeans because their bodies contain, particularly people from West Africa, certain mutations that make them the most immune to malaria of any people on Earth. I'm skipping a lot of technical details. There's actually two types of malaria and so on. But the basic thing is that Africans are much less likely to get sick. And so people who import them have an economic advantage over people who import Europeans. And the result is that in malaria areas, the Columbian Exchange is actually kind of nudging these societies towards slavery. Now, it doesn't mean that malaria causes slavery. Obviously, people are moral agents and make their own decisions. But we all know what the lure of the market is, and you just have a better chance of making a success out of your operation if you bring in people who won't get sick immediately.
I love the story that you tell in your book about guano, bird dung. This is, I think, one of the real high points of the book. And you said, bird dung, guano, was discovered, in South America to be a great fertilizer. And when the Europeans came and they realized what a good fertilizer it was, they wanted to bring it back to Europe. So how do they go about doing that?
Well, the guano came from these islands off the coast of Peru, the Chincha Islands, which had been the home for seabirds for, millennia. And the seabirds had built up these enormous kind of mountains of guano, some of them 200 or 300 feet deep. And effectively what they set up were guano mines, complete with mining carts and people with pick and shovels. Now, this is just about the most awful work you can imagine. And so, of course, no Peruvians wanted to do this. So what they did was they brought over Asian slaves, thousands of them, digging this stuff. And mining conditions for the guano were just, no matter how ghastly they are, the more you read about it, they're more ghastly than you imagined. For instance, my favorite little sort of horrifying detail is that in the guano are little crystals of ammonia. So when your axe was, whacking into the cliff wall of guano, there's little bomb bursts of ammonia going off. And then you would load it into these carts and dump it down this long chute several hundred feet into the hold of a waiting ship. And there more slaves would be down there, more Chinese slaves. And this stuff would just explode. And they would be completely naked with cloths wrapped around their face trying to shovel out this stuff. It was just horrifying.
It sounds really horrible. And it ended up being a big scandal.
Right. No, it's even for the 19th century, this was a bit much. And there were, I'm happy to say, as a journalist, there were enterprising reporters who exposed this. and there were efforts to reform it, mostly ineffectual. What really happened was that the Peruvians exhausted the guano deposits and then moved on to deposits of nitrates in Chile.
So as horrible as this, like, slave colony of guano miners was, you write that the guano trade also launched modern agriculture and
yes.
and some of its worst pitfalls. But so how did the guano trade launch modern agriculture?
The way that a modern farm works is that, you know, the land is kind of like a petri dish, and you pour in nutrients in the form of, you know, high-intensity fertilizers, and you plant in the crops you want to grow, and then you spray on, you know, the pest protection that you need. And it's a scientific way of farming that was really invented in the 1840s, and it's totally dependent on high-input fertilizers, on, you know, heavy fertilization to get these fantastic yields. And there's just no question about it. Modern agriculture has been this tremendous boom. I mean, you know, famine is basically, compared to what it was, you know, it's almost eradicated in the world. Obviously, there's still very many hungry people, but it's just absolutely nothing like what it was 200 or 300 years ago. But it depends on this system that was invented in Peru and brought over to the Americas in the 1840s, and it has serious pitfalls.
Like?
Well, one of the things that happened was the Peruvians brought over the fertilizer and was, you know, spread all over European fields. And with it came some Peruvian potatoes. Potatoes are, you know, from Peru. And they were infected with a fungus-like organism. It's called an O, mycete, that causes potato blight. And in 1845, we had the first, you know, right after the, you know, shipment of the first guano, we had the first modern agricultural disaster when the potato blight exploded over Europe and, you know, sort of wiped out the potatoes in a 2,000-mile range from, you know, Ukraine all the way to Ireland. Ireland, which was the heaviest potato consumer in the world, there's these studies that the average Irish person ate, you know, some fantastic amount of potatoes a day, like laborers ate 20 pounds of potatoes a day or something absurd like this. Anyway, there are 40% of the people in Ireland or something like that ate nothing but potatoes for solid food, and all that vanished in a matter of weeks. And there was massive starvation. It was horrifying. And about 1 million Irish people died. Many, many more fled the country. And as a result, Ireland, I mean, it was such a huge disaster for Ireland that the country still hasn't recovered today, 150 years later. And Ireland today has fewer people now than it did 150 years ago. And it's got to be the only country in the world that's in the same borders that has fewer people now than it did 150 years ago.
So let me see if I understand this correctly. The potato is originally from Peru.
Yes.
Ends up
and so are the potato pests.
Right. It ends up originally among other countries in Ireland. And then the potato pests maybe came in the form of guano that shipped to Europe and then kills the potatoes.
Right.
So you've got this kind of like complete like loop that's closed
right.
in this post-Columbian environmental exchange, ecological exchange.
Yeah. One of the things that happens is that when you bring a species out of its home range, you very frequently, when you transport it, bring it to a place where it doesn't have whatever predators and pests and so forth were keeping it down. And that's why if you go to the American Southeast, you see kudzu, right? It's like, you know, it's like Christo went crazy and draped the entire Southeast with this plant. And when I went to Japan for the first time, you see this little inoffensive thing on the sides of the roads. And I said, what is that? And they said, that's kudzu. And there's something about this, you know, there's this phenomenon called ecological release so that when kudzu comes out of Japan and comes into the U.S. Southeast, it goes bananas. And this happens again and again. So the potatoes brought out of Peru come to Europe, and they just thrive. You know, they do fantastically well. And then sooner or later, the pests follow and wipes them out. We're about to see another one of these disasters, actually.
We are?
Yeah. The Pará rubber tree, which is a Brazilian plant, is the main source for natural rubber. And even though, you know, natural rubber sounds like this thing that should be in health food stores or something, in fact, 40% of the world's rubber market depends on natural rubber. And it's what's in your tires. It's, you know, airplane tires are 100% made out of it because it's so expensive to synthesize, you know, artificial rubber of the quality of natural rubber that basically people don't do it. It's just way too expensive. And so natural rubber is really important. And it's grown over a huge area, this Brazilian tree in Southeast Asia, spreading from, you know, the very tip of southern China all the way down to Malaysia and Indonesia. It covers an area, you know, more or less the size of Great Britain in rubber plantations. Now, all of these are grown from a few seedlings of rubber that were smuggled over from in the 1870s from Brazil to Kew Gardens, where they were raised and then transplanted in Europe. And they're all vulnerable to a disease, another sort of fungus-type disease, a fungus called, well, I won't give you the scientific name, but the disease is called South American leaf blight. And they've been protected by the fact that there's just relatively little, you know, air traffic between the Amazon and Southeast Asia. But Brazil is becoming a wealthier country. Southeast Asia's nations are becoming wealthier. And sooner or later, just as the potato blight came from Peru to Ireland, the South American leaf blight will come through there. And, you know, this will be a big deal.
So your new book, 1493, is about how the world was environmentally changed, how ecosystems were changed after Columbus and subsequent European explorers came to the Americas. So what's one or two of the things you wish students were being taught in school now about Columbus?
That I would wish that students were taught what a tremendous landmark in human history 1492 was. That, you know, it was the beginning of the modern world, and that two huge things happened as a result of it to the human race itself. The first was that through these things that we've been describing, there was this tremendous die-off of native people, and it's been estimated that, you know, one out of every five people on the planet died in the next 100 years as a result of this unintentional bringing over of diseases. And the second thing is that what happened after the Europeans came was not so much that Europeans came, but that Africans came. The number of Africans who came to the Americas up to about 1840, 1850 far outweighed the number of Europeans. There are three Africans for every European who came to the Americas in those first couple hundred years.
And this is because of slavery.
Because of slavery. And so the Europeans who came, like, you know, many of my ancestors in the later part of the 19th century, came to landscapes that had been radically changed, but they had, and to new cities. But those cities had been built by African hands. The landscapes had been reworked by African hands. The boats that were going up and down the rivers were piloted by had African crews. And so that there was a tremendous change in the very distribution of the human race on the planet as a result of Columbus.
Well, Charles Mann, thank you so much. You have all kinds of things in the book that I never knew and never thought about. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Charles Mann is the author of 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. The film adaptation of Catherine Stockett's best-selling novel, The Help, opened this week. It's set in the early 60s, at the dawn of the Civil Rights era. The story is told from three different points of view. Two African-American maids working for white families in Jackson, Mississippi, and a young white woman who wants to write about them. The film was written and directed by Tate Taylor and stars Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer as the maids and Emma Stone as the writer. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Few fictional films wear their political messages as proudly or loudly as The Help, which centers on black female domestic servants in Jackson, Mississippi in the early 60s, and a 23-year-old white woman who induces them to tell their stories for a book to be called, appropriately enough, The Help. Emma Stone plays the perky white woman, Eugenia Phelan, nicknamed Skeeter, who returns from college to find her wealthy family's maid, who essentially raised her, gone under mysterious circumstances, and her friends married with kids and black maids of their own. After Skeeter talks her way into a newspaper job, ghostwriting a column on housekeeping, a subject about which she knows nothing, she reaches out for advice to her friend Elizabeth's maid, Abilene, played by Viola Davis. But as racial tensions intensify and her snooty friends reveal their true segregationist selves, Skeeter prevails on Abilene to give her more than household cleaning tips.
Something else I want to write about. I would need your help. I want to interview you about what it's like to work as a maid. I'd like to do a book of interviews about working for white families. And we could show what it's like to work for, say, Elizabeth.
You know what Miss Leaf would do to me if she knew I was telling stories on her?
Well, I was thinking that we wouldn't have to tell her. The other maids would have to keep it a secret, too.
Other maids?
Well, I was hoping to get four or five. To show what it's really like in Jackson.
Getting those other maids turns out to be a problem until the insults become even harder to bear. The imperious Hilly Holbrook, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, announces it's unhygienic to let black people use their house toilets and directs her friends to build outhouses. Then Hilly dumps her aging mother's maid, Minnie, played by Octavia Spencer, for being what's often called sassy. Although Medgar Evers has just been murdered and the KKK is on the prowl, Minnie finally agrees to talk to Skeeter too, but not before laying down the law.
All right, I'm gonna do it. But I need to make sure she understands this ain't no game we playing here. Slide your chap under the table. Face me. I need to see you square on at all times. I got to come up with your questions, too?
Oh. Let's begin with where you were born.
Belzona, Mississippi, on my great-auntie's sofa.
The Help is based on a novel by Catherine Stockett, both beloved for opening wide eyes to the vantage of maltreated servants and attacked in some quarters as a white author's appropriation of black women's experience. Some of Stockett's critics have gone so far as to say she actually romanticizes domestic servitude by depicting black nannies' genuine love for the white children in their care. They also say the novel is full of stock characters that reinforce classic African-American stereotypes like the sassy maid and the shiftless, abusive husband. My view of this controversy is easily stated. I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. I concede the novel and movie are heavy-handed, but I also think they're full of good evocative details, closely observed depictions of the coping mechanisms of both servants and employers. The white Southern belle's passive aggression, condescension, and sheer misuse of power come through vividly. Director Tate Taylor has a dull, square style with too many close-ups, but the faces we get close to are great ones. Emma Stone is amazingly vivid, at once blurty and brainy, and villainous Bryce Dallas Howard lifts her nose and slits her eyes with aplomb. Jessica Chastain plays a handsome rich guy's hot, uneducated wife who hires Minnie on the sly to teach her how to clean and cook. The character has been simplified. In the novel, she's scarily unstable. But Chastain makes her helplessness hilarious. Allison Janney triumphs over countless banalities as Skeeter's oblivious mother, and Sissy Spacek has some funny scenes as Hilly's mom, derisive toward her daughter, even in her dottiness. Octavia Spencer's Minnie is indeed a stereotype, but she charges into the frame and gives her scenes a lift. The center of the Help is Viola Davis, who has eyes unlike other actresses. They're hard, unyielding, with no give-back, softening only for the neglected little girl in her care. It's a tough, beautifully judged performance. The weak, weepy, uplifting ending is odd, given Mississippi's imminent eruption. But there will be wet hankies everywhere. The Help is the highest form of middle brow.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Hugh Herr, sometimes jokes that he feels sorry for people who have both legs because those legs can't be upgraded like his can. Herr had both legs amputated below the knee after getting frostbite during an unexpected snowstorm while mountain climbing. That was back in 1982, when he was 17. Now he walks on robotic prosthetic legs. As we'll hear, they do things that his intact legs never could have done. He expects that their capabilities will keep improving, and he can say that with authority, since he helps design them. Her has worked at MIT's Leg Lab and Media Lab and now directs MIT's Biomechatronics Research Group. He is the holder or co-holder of 14 patents related to assistive devices, including a computer-controlled artificial knee. One aspect of prosthetics on which he's focusing is how amputees can control the movements of their robotic limbs via signals from their nerves or brains. Her is one of the people profiled in a new book about innovative technologies developed in MIT's Media Lab. The book, The Sorcerers and Their Apprentices, is by former Media Lab director Frank Moss. Terry spoke with Hugh Her last week.
Hugh Her, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the artificial legs that you designed that you're wearing today?
The legs that I'm wearing today, they're called Powerfoot Biomes. They're an ankle-foot prosthesis. So my legs are amputated below the knee, about 6 inches. So from there down to the floor, I'm artificial. I'm titanium, carbon, silicone, a bunch of nuts and bolts. My limbs that I wear have 5 computers, 12 sensors, and muscle-like actuator systems that enable me to move throughout my day.
How do you activate the computers? Like, if I want to move my foot, I just think, move the foot, and it moves. How do you get your foot to move?
Well, in the future, I'll have neural implants within my biological body. But for now, the artificial limb itself has its own intelligence. So when I push on it and when I change its positions, it responds in a natural way. So when I want to walk faster, I simply walk faster, and it outputs the right torques and energies.
Do you have other artificial lower legs at home that you wear for other occasions?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a running pair. I have a bionic walking pair, limbs that are waterproof, various limbs for climbing mountains, summer, to ascend steep rock ice walls, spiked feet that penetrate ice walls, other feet that wedge into small rock fissures, others that stand on small rock edges the width of a coin. So probably about 8 pair or so.
Wow. I think it's amazing that you can still do all those things that you mentioned, climbing mountains, climbing ice with your artificial legs. Are there things your artificial legs can do that your real legs couldn't have?
Oh, absolutely. My legs were amputated in 1982. And I quickly realized that from the knees down, I was a blank palette for which to create. I could create any type of limb that would afford me various physical capabilities. So I quickly realized that, well, if I want to climb a mountain, I could make my artificial limbs very, very lightweight, lighter than human flesh. But I had the same strength in my upper body, so I could do more pull-ups before fatiguing. When I climb a steep ice wall, I no longer have calf fatigue. When I'm on my front points, it feels like I'm standing on a sidewalk. It's fantastic.
You know, I like this idea that your prosthetic legs can keep getting better and better and designed for all kind of specialty needs, while our real limbs get more worn out with age. So yours can improve.
Absolutely.
When real ones tend not to after a certain age.
Yeah, it's interesting because my biological body will degrade in time, but the artificial part of my body improves in time because I can upgrade. So I predict that when I'm 80 years old, I'll be able to walk with less energy. I'll probably be able to run faster than a person with biological limbs. So it's quite interesting that, in fact, my artificial part of my body is, in some sense, immortal.
You started needing artificial limbs when you were 17 that you had your accident?
Yes, the tender age of 17, that's correct.
Tell us what happened.
My climbing partner at the time, Jeff Batzer, we traveled to New Hampshire to climb Mount Washington. It was January. We headed up towards what's called the Huntington's Ravine, and we climbed about a 700-foot ice face called Odell's Gully. When we got to the top of the face, we decided to continue towards the summit of the mountain, and the weather conditions became more and more severe. The snow was blinding. The wind speeds were very, very high. We could barely stand. We mistakenly descended down what's called the Great Gulf region of Mount Washington. And it's the wilderness side of Mount Washington. And it was there that we spent several days trying to stay alive, digging snow caves, hugging each other to stay warm. Through that process, we made it to within just a few miles of a roadway of civilization. But at that point, we were no longer able to walk. We suffered some severe frostbite and hypothermia. And we, because of the frostbite, we could only walk a few paces for, before losing our balance and toppling over. Fortunately, a person was out snowshoeing for the day, discovered human footprints, our footprints, followed them to our snow cave, and we were rescued from the mountain via helicopter.
Did you think you would survive and before you were rescued?
No, I thought we would freeze to death the first night. But it turns out by hugging one another, by sharing body heat, we were able to survive for quite a long time. But near the end, when we were both not able to walk even three paces before toppling over, that's when we both gave up hope. And we actually stopped hugging each other. And our strategy was the sooner we die, the better. We were in excruciating pain.
So when you were rescued and you found out that you would live, but then you found out that your legs were going to be amputated, what went through your mind in terms of that mix of the positive side knowing that you'd live and the negative side of knowing that you would never physically be the same again?
Well, our physical condition to me was the least of my concern. We were plucked from the mountain, and we were told immediately that a rescuer had died, a volunteer rescuer, Albert Dow.
Rescuing you?
Yeah, he and a partner were in Huntington's Ravine, and while descending, they were hit by an avalanche. So the news of that was just horrible, horrible. You know, I really didn't care what was happening with my physical body.
I can have some sense of how devastating that must have been. The amputation eventually changed your life around because you found your calling, which is designing artificial limbs. But before finding your calling, did you go through a period of abject depression?
Yeah, immediately after the accident, I was very, very angry with myself, of putting myself and my partner in that situation, as well as other climbers, and someone ended up getting hurt, someone ended up dying. So I wasn't really depressed. There was a severe, intense anger, and out of that anger came this extraordinarily swelling of energy and a desire to not wallow in self-pity, but to do something worthwhile with my life.
Would you describe the first prosthetic legs that you were given, what they were capable of doing, and what it physically felt like to wear them?
After my legs were amputated, I was home in a wheelchair for a month. And then I was sent to a rehabilitation center. And at that center, I was fitted with my first prostheses. The prostheses were made of a plaster of Paris. And they actually told me to not walk without canes because the added force of walking without canes may actually fracture the plaster. So the devices were very, very crude. And I remember distinctly, I was in a wheelchair. They put these artificial limbs on me made of plaster, and I pressed up on parallel bars with arms fully extended, and then I slowly put weight on my legs, and I never felt such excruciating pain in my life. I think I stood there for a second and immediately sat down again.
At what point did you think about designing a better version of the prosthetic leg?
The prostheses that were provided to me were designed for the the horizontal world and for walking very, very slowly on a horizontal surface. They were not designed for fast walking, for running. They were not designed for the vertical world of rock and ice climbing. After the accident, I dreamed of returning to my chosen sport of mountain climbing. So it immediately became apparent to me that what I needed to do is design my own artificial limbs. So I had training in machining and carving metals and woods and making artifacts. So I went into the shop and I started grinding and cutting and designing various limbs, designing various foot structures that were conducive to the vertical world of rock and ice climbing.
What was the first prosthetic like that you designed?
Very early, initially I put a rock climbing boot over the prosthetic foot, and then I said, well, that's silly, and I threw out the shoe. And then I realized, well, the foot need not look like a human foot. So, you know, to climb a vertical rock face, I really don't need a heel, so I cut off the heel, prosthetic heel. It was just extra weight that I didn't need. And I started then optimizing how the angle of the foot relative to the calf of the prosthesis, the size of the foot. My rock climbing feet are the size of baby feet. They're very, very small, very, very short, so I can get the center of my body over my feet on a vertical wall. So through all this tinkering, I was actually able to climb at a more advanced level after my accident with artificial limbs than I'd ever achieved before my accident.
You said earlier that one of the things you're hoping to accomplish with your artificial limbs is to find a way where they can be neurally connected to you so that you can think, move, and they will move. How in the world are you thinking about going about doing that?
Well, there's a number of research groups worldwide developing what are called neural implants. For most persons with limb amputations, they would have what's called a peripheral neural interface, which would comprise of small electronic packages that are implanted into muscle in the residual limb to measure the degree to which the muscle has been activated electrically by the spinal cord. And there'd also be small electronic packages attached to nerves. When a limb is amputated, obviously key nerves are transected or amputated. So in the future, there'll be electronic packages that communicate in a bidirectional way with the amputated nerve. They'll measure motor information, how the person wishes to move, descending commands from the spinal cord, and there'll be stimulation ports to stimulate the nerve endings to reflect the sensory information from the artificial limb onto the human nervous system. One day, amputees will not only be able to walk across sand, but they'll be able to feel the sand against their synthetic prosthesis.
What you're describing seems so just totally far out, but I mean, the fact that you've accomplished what you have so far makes me think, well, maybe it's really possible.
When you look at prosthetic innovation over history, what you'll see is spikes in innovation during and after every major war.
Mm-hmm.
So World War II, for example, there's a tremendous progress in prosthetic design. The current conflict that we now find ourselves in Iraq and Afghanistan, we're now seeing a tremendous innovation spike. There's several reasons for that. One is there's a lot of funding now from the U.S. government to fund research in this area of science and technology. Another reason why it's an interesting time is that over the last several decades, key disciplines have matured that are relevant to prosthetic design. Robotics, tissue engineering, artificial intelligence. And we now find ourselves in a position that if we cleverly integrate these disciplines, we can put forth truly bionic limbs that fundamentally improve the quality of life of persons with limb amputation.
Why do you still climb? You were in a horrible blizzard. You came so close to dying. You lost the bottom of your legs. You lost your feet. Somebody died trying to rescue you. You felt really guilty and angry at yourself. And you designed these artificial limbs, which in part have enabled you to keep climbing. Why would you go back to it after such catastrophe?
Well, I've been climbing mountains since the age of 7. To me, it's as natural as walking. Climbing is a vertical dance. It requires both physical power and also grace, graceful movements. So it's always been a part of my life. It's absolutely exhilarating and wonderful, and it's something that I didn't want to give up. And it was really the first expression of how I could exploit technology attached to my body in a way that was positive and that would help others.
Did you ever climb that mountain again, the one where you got lost and got hypothermia and frostbite?
I have, yes. And I have 2 daughters. They're 6 and 8 years old. And my daughters have climbed the mountain as well. So it's wonderful to now see them ascending these glorious mountains that I ascended when I was young as well.
Well, Yuher, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure. I wish you well, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Yuher, speaking with Terry Gross. Her heads the Biomechatronics Research Group and MIT's Media Lab, and is one of the people profiled in the new book, The Sorcerers and Their Apprentices. You can see pictures of him wearing his prosthetic legs on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can now find podcasts of our weekend show. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sherrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, and Heidi Simon. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cool.